now you've done this collection and this so-called analysis, and it's time to retain and present. So generally then you have to worry about transporting of the evidence, about loss of data, storage and media, of the media and the data, retention requirements, preparing the presentation, process requirements, the mosaic of the case, presentation strategies, and so forth. So we'll work our way through that. Transportation, many digital forms are delicate. Now when I say delicate, there are different kinds of delicate. Right? Like you take a floppy disk, you can toss it on the table, and most of the time it retains the data. Okay? Hardly delicate. You can fly it like a frisbee and it's not that delicate. But it's delicate in other ways. In fact, as we saw earlier today, it might be delicate to all sorts of things, but temperature sensitive, both hot and cold. If you take a disk and freeze it, really cold, it'd be like, you know, like a potato chip. Okay? One tap and it's gone. If you get it too warm, 110 degrees for any length of time, and it'll lose its mind. Shaking can damage many forms of digital evidence, especially electromagnetic storage media. Shaking or banging or impulses to the media. Bending the connectors can make them fail. You have a disk and you disconnect the disk from the system, and you don't disconnect it square and clean, but you sort of lift it off to the side as you're wont to do when the connectors aren't real good. You may bend one of those connectors, especially on these SCSI, the 50 and 60 some odd pin SCSI connectors and other similar small connectors. When you plug them back in, one of those connectors might just be bent off to the side and never go in, and the disk won't work and you won't know why. That happens all the time. Static electricity can wipe out chips and cause other similar effects. Dust, chemicals, water, and other factors can harm it, especially things like CD-ROMs, right? CD-ROMs are disks, a little piece of dust will wipe the thing out, cause the disk head to bounce up and down and make lots of little circular scratch marks all over your disk. Chemicals can eat away at the various things that are used in the storage media. They can eat away at the plastic or the metal that underlies the substrate, the storage media. They also can eat away at the glue that binds things from one another. The stick-on disk labels that you put on CD-ROMs, on the back of CD-ROMs, can actually chemically affect the CD-ROM reflective material and wipe out a CD-ROM. Okay, so the label both protects you from accidentally scratching the back, which will wipe it out, but if you try to lift the label off, or if the label has the wrong kind of glue and so forth. Water, other factors, all sorts of factors. Water can, of course, it gets collected by tapes, water, and it oxidizes the metal in the tape. Time can cause things to decay, just because over time things get old. There are various chemical processes and other aging phenomena that happen. Spores and fungi. Spores and fungi can damage various kinds of media. In fact, in some cases, fungus can eat away at rubber and plastics at a rapid rate, especially if you're in places near the equator. Your tires on automobiles get eaten away, engine parts, seals and engines get eaten away by the fungus and the other biological agents and materials. Magnets and light can damage various of the media. Bits go away with time unless they're maintained. So electromagnetism withers with time. Optical discs are susceptible to fungi and other things. Mag tapes become brittle or warped in other ways. Discs can become warped from temperature gradients. They can crack and so forth. Microfiche degrades and can become a combustible, like other sorts of film. If you leave it in the vaults long enough, you know there are big film fires from movies that sit there over time. It's essentially a chemical leaches out of the film because of the acetate that the films were made of. So the acetate leaches out of the film and it starts to degrade the film, but it also becomes extremely flammable. And in fact, sometimes it can spontaneously combust if pressure and temperature are set appropriately. So only really active maintenance on live systems can really be used to keep it right for long periods of time. But of course, live systems are susceptible to other events. Okay, so if you want to make sure the data is right, you need to keep it on a live system and keep checking it all the time. And if it changes or degrades in some way, you need to then have the backup system where you were also checking it along the way, immediately restore the corrected version so that you always have enough versions that are currently operational and being checked periodically at reasonable intervals so that when one starts to degrade, the redundancy can be used to replace that and it gets undegraded, and the aggregate system has the ability to retain the data over an extended period of time. And of course, you then need to move from new technology to new technology to keep the bits. But of course, original evidence for the purpose of forensics is not the same as those bit-for-bit copies. Okay, now there are ways that you can, for example, do MD5 checksums to assure that the bits are the same as the bits originally were. But original evidence is original evidence, and the courts aren't necessarily eager to recognize bit-for-bit copies, especially considering that the so-called bit-for-bit copies aren't always actually bit-for-bit copies. Proving that they're clean and original and pure and unaltered and so forth is non-trivial. And of course, keeping it on these live systems means if somebody breaks into one of the live systems, they could corrupt the data and you wouldn't know about it, whereas something that's locked in a safe is a lot harder. So another activity would be to take a couple of disk drives and besides imaging the disk drives, take the physical disk drives and lock them away in a safe too, and so forth. And there are other similar techniques. So you want to store the media and the data in a cool, dry place, free of fungi, free of other chemicals and so forth, no temperature cycling, so that the temperature remains steady, no humidity cycling, so the humidity range remains steady and in the right humidity range for the media. And you have to look at the details of the media to know what that is. No EMP, electromagnetic pulse effects. So you want to keep it in a Faraday cage, you know, reasonably metallically shielded from various electromagnetic pulses and emanations and power supplies and so forth. You need to periodically review it and reread it to make sure it's still right. Use crypto checksums to verify that it's unaltered, or hopefully with redundancy be able to repair it. CRC codes and other data recovery methods can be applied, and redundancy. And that's how you make sure that it's right over a long period of time. Fortunately, you don't have to keep it forever. In most legal cases, there's 7 years for a lot of corporate and some legal data before it becomes evidence, so you don't have to retain it forever. 4 years for a lot of civil course data, civil type of data. Accounting records, 7 to 10 years or longer, depending on IRS regulations and other similar laws. Email as a normal business record has to be retained, although some people now have policies that eliminate it rapidly. This is untested in court. Log files, which are kept as normal business records, have retention requirements. You need to check with your legal staff and get their opinion. And by the way, if they're wrong because they don't know enough, you may find yourself in big trouble. There are also process requirements. You need to properly obtain the evidence with the permission of the owner, permission of the suspect, or a search warrant. Chain of custody has to be maintained. You have to properly find it, collect it, annotate it, take it apart, transport it, search it, analyze it, store it, track it, and other copies have to be properly tracked along the way, and copies have to be provided to the other side. And of course, exculpatory as well as inculpatory evidence all has to be presented. You need to make sure all the evidence is available, and it's better if you present it than if they present it. So this process requirement can be fairly substantial and fairly onerous, and of course keeping good notes and so forth is very important. So just like any other evidence, you have to get to it in time, or it won't be there anymore. It has to be collected properly. If you don't use adequate technique or method, that can be questioned. You have to transport it properly, hold it securely, analyze it carefully. You have to leave the evidence, original evidence, intact and touch as little as possible, and keep track of everybody that's ever touched it or had access to it, and mark and write all that stuff down. You need to be able to show you that your analysis can be repeated so that it can be appropriately tested and challenged by a scientific method. It has to be available for the defense if you're on the prosecution side, the prosecution if you're on the defense side. It has to be presentable in court. It has to be explainable in court. It's not just that it's there, it's that you can show it to somebody and make sense out of it. And believe me, it's not that simple to take bits on a disk and turn them into something that people can understand and show that that process didn't just make up the bits out of your head. Just because it's in a computer doesn't make it right, which is another problem. There's a predisposition of some people to believe that it's right because it was in a computer, and other people believe it was wrong because it was in a computer. Who got it for you? who told who else when. Example, serve an ISP, the ISP calls the defendant, the defendant destroys the evidence. So figuring out how to do this properly and getting a system of controls in place and having it consistent and functional in your organization is a vital part of getting this process to work right. Of course, mosaics are rarely perfect in digital evidence. They're always missing pieces, slightly off pieces, even extra pieces. Yes, that's right. It's just like a real puzzle, right? You ever put together a, you know, oh, here. Ever take apart an engine and put it back together and find out that it worked, but you got this extra piece? Ooh, well, it does work. What's this extra piece? Well, must not have been important. Wonder what that thing is. I don't know. Generally, you know, there are reasons that you have missing slightly off and extra pieces, and they can be demonstrated. But in the end, the real issue is, you know, does it look like the suspect? How revealing is it? And is it consistent with the other non-digital evidence? Typical mosaic, a suspect with means, motive, opportunity, an asserted chain of events that took place, and that can be nicely shown and analyzed as a process. Evidence of some portion of the process, portions of the chain are often missing, but not necessarily critical, like the record of packets passing through an infrastructure. They're not critical to the evidence, but they're clearly not there. Demonstrations of the crime and its criminality. So these chain of events must have produced a crime, otherwise, so what? Yes, these things happened, but there was no crime. And then there are counter arguments that need to try and refute. The presentation, hopefully you present the mosaic of the case in all its glory. You show the process that you assert took place, you step through the evidence supporting your process, you address any weaknesses or strengths along the way, not waiting for the opposition to come up with them, summarize the evidence in the context of the process, and draw your conclusions, if any. You need to also provide the basis for drawing any of those conclusions. That is, how did you come to that conclusion? And address other possible interpretations. There's other ways that people could have come to different results, and here they are, and here's why I think they're wrong. By the way, in my experience, juries do not understand log files. Yes, believe it or not, members of juries do not understand Unix audit trails at all. So what you need to do is explain it to them. Demonstrations help a lot. So show the user what the user does and how the computer records it, records of the crime, and conclude that they were generated by the perpetrator doing what you showed. So you take a computer system, you set it up, and you say, here's a computer system. You know, and you have a board and maybe a real computer, and you show on the board, here's what you do. You type this command, here's the process of executing the command, here are the little droppings that it leaves. And you go to a real computer and you execute the command, and then you show them the droppings. Okay, and then you work your way through it. You say, all right, so here's what we think they did in the crime, and here's the series of droppings that it leaves. We'll do those things on the computer. Now we'll go to the evidence that came from the actual computer, and here's the same droppings. We think this is what they did. Are there other ways to produce those droppings? Yes, there are. Let me give you some examples. I could have come into this computer system and simply created the droppings without ever having done any of these things by modifying these files in place. There would have been these droppings resulting from that modification process, and we didn't find those on the computer. But that doesn't preclude the possibility that somehow somebody figured out a way to do it that I don't understand. Okay? So what do you believe? Do you believe that the suspect broke into this computer and created fake droppings to make it look like he committed a crime? Or do you believe he committed a crime? It's up to you to decide, right? You probably don't want to push the fake droppings too far, but you get the idea. Are there other ways to generate it? Yeah, tell us about it. You know, join together multiple sources to form a pattern that makes it harder and harder to figure out that some way this could have happened other than the way that you say it happened. The other side's going to say, it could happen this way. And what you want to do is you want to be able to say, you know, that's an interesting point. It could happen that way. Here's what we did to show that it didn't happen that way. If you would have done that, I'll reproduce it for you, O jury. We'll do it that way. Here are the droppings that it left. It left the same droppings, but it also left this dropping over here. Now let's look at the real system. Son of a gun, that dropping wasn't there. I guess they must not have done that, huh? Next challenge. So that tends to be very effective. So after you show the big picture, get into the details. So I'm going to just walk you through an example. Here's the evidence against John. His last name is Doe. Turns out that we believe that John left home on that morning and went to the Miller Public Library, arriving at about 8:45. So John's home was at 27 Market Street. He went over to the Miller Public Library, Got there about 8:45. Then he used TTY-23 and attempted to transfer some key government files from a government address, 24.1.84.100, which is a known drop site for the Spies R Us group. And we believe actually that the process was that went through port 5 at Mindspring, May West at NASA, home.com, Livermore 5 at home.com, and then 24.1.84.100. He then took the downloaded information and placed them on a floppy disk and returned to his home at 27 Marketplace. That's what we believe happened in the crime. So, let's see. He left his home that morning, went to the library at 8:45. At 8:45, John called the office and indicated that he would be late. That's what Mary at the office said. Then the postmaster tried to deliver mail requiring a signature at 9 a.m. and nobody was home. So somehow John left between 8:15 and 9. A nosy neighbor saw him leave during the commercial in the morning television program, and that commercial, according to the television station, was at such and such a time, 8:37. He returned to the library books just before 9 a.m., according to the librarian, and the computer records at the library verify that. So that's why we believe that's what John did. Then we believe he used TTY-23 and attempted to transfer key government files from 24.184.100, a known drop site for Spies R Us. Records at 24.184.100 indicate that the activity happened from TTY-23 at the Miller Public Library. The path between these is consistent with how packets might go from TTY-23 at the Miller Public Library to 24.1.84.100. There's residual data from one of those files was found on TTY-23 at the Miller Public Library. We found that residual data in a deleted file there. And there's also hair consistent with John Doe that was found on the TT-23 keyboard at Miller Public Library. We found some of his hair in the keyboard. The next step. He then took the downloaded information and placed it on a floppy disk, returning it to his home at 27 Market Street. So let's see, we have the floppies in John's house, shown over here, actually contain the information. The residual data found on 23 had the same data as was found on one of the floppies at John's home. The data was, in fact, a trade secret of one of the victims. The data was also found on 24.1.84.100. And John's fingerprints were on these floppies. Okay? This also, shows mens rea, because he could have done it from home, but he chose to obfuscate his activities by going to the library. So that means he was intentionally trying to do it in an obscure way so he couldn't be traced down. And here's actually the data that we found. It says the dimensions of the intergalactic mode resonance enhanced field neutron generator must be more than the width of the filament used to induce the flux capacitors, negative, so forth. And it was both on this system here and on 24.184.100, on the floppies in John's house in his possession, and in the residual data found on TTY-23 at the Miller Public Library. Some other issues. The date and time stamps on the files and the floppies were not those of the crime, but it turns out that when you examine TTY-23, it's normally skewed by a similar amount of time to the skew found on the floppy disks. So that TTY-23 at Miller Public Library was off by an hour and a half when we examined it, and that was the same as the time that those floppies were off that John had at his house. Someone also maybe could have forged the records at 24.184.100, but the records on that computer appear to be very meticulous. But even if they were forged, that how could they then have forged the data on TTY-23 at Miller Public Library and also on the floppies at John's house? So the notion that the data in one of these places was forged isn't right. It would have to be forged in all three of these places. That would indicate quite a serious conspiracy. So we figure John took the trade secrets from 24.1.84.100. He knew it was a crime, and he tried to cover it up by using the public library as his way. Okay. My evidence is done. What do you think, jury? Sound pretty bad for John? Probably got them, huh? Okay, here are some ways you might challenge the evidence. Of course, there are two sides to every story. And the other side is, of course, obliged to do their best. So, you can count on them trying. And of course, the goal is to have the best evidence you can get. No case or evidence is ever perfect, and no person is ever perfect. So expect to be challenged. Don't become defensive, and don't take sides. Just work the facts. Accuracy is going to be brought into question. Computer records are, of course, not always accurate. Times and dates are very often off. Comparing them to a standard, for example, you can go to my website and press what time is it, and it'll go off to the Naval Observatory and tell you what time they think it is, which is pretty darn good. You note your computer's time, note the Navy's time. That tells you the time differential between, you know, Navy standard global time and your computer's time. And then you can use that differential as a basis for comparing the times from then on, unless times were changed. File time and date stamps, of course, can be altered. And you can, here's an example of an exercise that you can do to show just how they can be altered by commands. Inaccuracies can be intentional. And so for those of you that are in an online class that have access to the system, you can go and look at various of these attacks. For example, the Cloak and Cloak 2 programs wipe information from VAR ADM and UTEMP on a Unix box. It's fully automatic. You need to be privileged to do it. You can hide your processes. You can create backdoors into systems and so forth. These are all ways of avoiding audit trails or modifying them. There's the issue of time limits. Real-time capture is sometimes possible, for example, network traffic, telephone calls, and internet relay chat sessions. Rapid capture on the order of hours to days, things like ISP dial-in, system logs, backups, and cache files. To tell that to Defender, here's, again, examples of things that you can do to watch these kinds of audit trails on systems. There's also analysis of things like PDAs, personal data systems, which can run out of power and lose memory. Disks, tapes, and CDs, which have like 1 to 2 year expected lifetime in a normal handling, unless you're very good at it. Some last a lot longer. Heat and magnets and so forth can destroy them, as we've discussed. And of course, data leads to other data. So there's an example of screw-ups. There was an attack reported to the FBI in April of 1998. They finally decided to investigate in January of 1999. 7 months later, they're going to try and go to an ISP and look up internet logs. Not bloody likely, right? Completeness is an issue. Most computer records are fairly minimal. They have maybe date, time, and a major event. Sometimes only the start times, not the end times of things. Sometimes only the end times, not the start times of things. Content's often missing. User information is highly limited. Better logs are easy to get. For example, you can install something to log keystrokes. You can tap specific IP addresses and ports. And so forth, but the log files take a lot of space, and that's why they tend to be limited. Computer records can also be missing things. Entire records could be missed. Attackers try to destroy the logs, they try to avoid the logs, they try to forge the logs, and there's almost always some evidence, however, of any kind of alteration if you're willing to look hard enough for it. And that's because these log files come in various types of redundancy. And you might read this paper that looks at some of these issues of redundant audit records. Question of admissibilities. Admissibility, most computer records come under the business records exemption from hearsay. See, any of these, you know, computer records, this is hearsay. This is, you know, somebody told somebody who told somebody, right? The computer told me, and now I'm telling you, but the computer told me, which is even less trustworthy than, you know, the lady down at the store told me, okay? Well, the way they come in is through expert testimony. Basically, the systems administrator declares that these were taken in the normal course of business. That makes them a normal business record, which means they're admissible under the normal business exception to hearsay evidence. It indicates that specific actions were taken to collect the records, shows them in the light of other records that are taken and kept by the company. The expert witness explains and interprets the records, and opposing experts make their claims. That works. How valid is it? Well, let's see. Computer data is easily altered, no question about it. By attackers, it's done in the normal course of events. The question often is whether the defender might have modified it to make it look like an attack. Did the systems administrator put this in there to make it look like Joe did this thing? That would be a typical question. By accident, all the time. For example, rarely, but occasionally, hardware faults cause things to be modified. Sometimes software faults. It's fairly common for software faults to cause some audit records in a computer to just be wrong or screwed up or missing or what have you. It happens. It's usually fairly easy to tell if it was altered. If it's, for example, it's gone completely over a period of time, right? A whole bunch of events happen on the computer system, but from 9 to 9:30 a.m. on Tuesday, nothing happened on this computer system, even though things happen every 14 seconds, all the rest of the time this computer system exists. Inconsistencies show up across audit trails. You might have two audit trails from different functions on the computer. One says something happened, the other one says it didn't, because they didn't erase both of them. It's hard to alter these things undetectably, but it might take a lot of effort to detect it. So now, I'm going to present the defense for John. Here's what really happened. John went to the Miller Public Library, arrived about 8:45 a.m. You're right about that. He returned his library books on time, as always, and you're right about that, too. He used TTY23 to cruise the web, and he did cruise the World Wide Web on TTY23. Then, he picked up the wrong disks from the desktop and then took them home. They were somebody else's disks that were on a desk sitting around there, and he took them home. Some spy must have copies of the web pages that John used. How silly. Picked up the wrong disk. Well, let me go into the details of defense. It's all true. What they said, John left home in the morning at 8:45. He called in. The postman came at 9, sure. Nosy neighbor saw him leaving, sure. And he returned his library books. It's all true. That's just exactly what John did. Somebody used TTY23 and attempted to transfer the key government files from spies or us. That's true. Somebody did that. I believe you. Absolutely. I believe that all these records are right and that that's what happened. But the somebody wasn't John. That was somebody else that was on TTY23 at that particular moment in time. It's a public library. People come and go. John sat down. Somebody else was there before him. Somebody else was after him. He doesn't particularly remember what they looked like. That's how it is. There was hair consistent with John found at TTY23 keyboard. Well, of course there was. John used TTY23 to surf the web. So that makes perfect sense. There would be hair samples of John there. So somebody did it. It just wasn't John. He took somebody else's floppy disk by accident when he went home. Right? You got floppy disk sitting on the desk? He took a disk. Yeah. He brought a disk to bring his web stuff home. He was surprised when he got home it wasn't there. Yeah, the floppies, you know, had the information, and so what? Yeah, it's probably all true. This might have been the victim's trade secrets, I believe you. But mens rea, no. A simple mistake. John just picked up the wrong floppy. That's the only thing John did. He was a victim of circumstances. What do you think? Is your all your digital evidence absolutely convincing to that jury? Or is John's explanation good enough to say, you know, it could have happened? I picked up a wrong floppy disk. Have you ever picked up a wrong floppy disk? Sure. Common mistake. John's a victim of circumstances. So, I guess you'd better have some more evidence. Oops. Digital evidence so far has never been the whole case in any successful litigation. That's never the whole situation. For example, gee, did John sell it? Was there money paid for those secrets when they were sold? Do you have a money trail that shows money going into John's Swiss bank account? If you could figure out which one that was. Timestamps indicate that nobody else could have used TTY at that time. Is that right? Was John using it from this time to that time? Were the timestamps such that it was impossible for John to have gone to his next destination and gone to the Miller Public Library as he now says that he did? He's now stipulated to certain parts of the facts. Is there somehow a way you can show it's impossible that anybody else could have done this in that time frame? Did that operation take so much time and have been done at the right time so that there was no way that it could have been anybody but John Doe, that he had to be part of it? John! What websites did you visit? What did you do there? Oh. I don't remember. Don't remember. Just sat down and cruised the web. Boy, the jury's not going to like that. So John better come up with something he did. Oh, I went to Alta Vista and I searched. You did? How interesting. Let's go check the audit records of Alta Vista. Hey, guess what? Alta Vista keeps great records. And they keep track of everybody that visited any of their web pages and where they came from. And you know what? Nobody came from Miller Public Library in that timeframe. Because we looked at their audit trails. Now, when John explains it to the jury and you come up with the audit trails, John's in big trouble. Maybe it was Yahoo. I can never tell the difference between them. You know what? We thought it might have been Yahoo, so we went to Yahoo too. Oh man, John's in big trouble. I don't really remember all the details. I just like to cruise the web. Is there a proxy at the library? Right? Look at the proxy server at the library, review the log files, and find out whether at that time frame somebody was going to those other places and cruising the web, or if the only activity was from particular sites. Actually, it turns out that John's defense is a pretty good defense, don't you think? If you don't have that other evidence, or if that evidence doesn't show what you're trying to show, son of a gun, you thought he was guilty of sin, and it turns out John's innocent. He accidentally picked up the wrong floppy. That's all he did that day. It was wrong. Poor John. How valid is evidence? Unaltered audit information is not always correct. That is, not altered doesn't mean correct. Forged email sessions. Okay, I mean, it's easy to do. And, and it looks just as real as the real thing if you do it, if you know what you're doing. If I break into user Joe, it always looks like Joe did it. So not only do you have to show it was user Joe, but you also somehow have to tie user Joe to physical Joe. And that's not so easy to do. Audit records fail during high load conditions for one reason or another. They fail under some various unanticipated conditions. Some programs don't produce records consistently. Sometimes they produce them and sometimes they don't. And if you don't know which program produces which records under what conditions, how can you show what was or was not the case? And audits can also often be avoided. So program audits, for example, are easily bypassed by not using the program to alter the data. Databases. The database program keeps an audit trail, but if you break out of the database interface and go directly to the file in the system, you can alter the database without that audit record showing up. Okay, and that's a very common technique for avoiding. Example, is the audit altered? A potentially altered audit trail in a civil suit, access to copies of the audit trail were provided. Analysis was done by comparing redundant audit trail entries from different audit trails. The comparison to file modification dates and so forth was used. The final result was that there were no detectable alterations. So alterations that would be an issue would have been detectable given the amount of time for the attack. And we're actually able to show that you could not have made them you could not have made the modifications in the available time without them being able to show up in the redundant audit trail, given the amount of available computing time. What are the limits of evidence? We're going to talk about that next time.